Well, hey, Rich, welcome back. And welcome back to our book club members. At the time that they're listening to this conversation, we're a couple more sections through your book, and it's good to be with you again.
It's good to be back for a good conversation.
Yeah, thanks. So last week we read the chapters on racial reconciliation, and this week we're going to read the chapters on interior examination. And you've given us lots to chew on. Thank you. So I wanted to start with, I love that story about the Korean dry cleaner and taking the bulletproof partition down. And you say you found out that these new owners who took the bulletproof partition down were Christians. And you say something had compelled them to imagine a different way of being together. And that word imagine just kind of shimmered for me. Like, is some of this like developing a gospel imagination around what's possible with race? Do you think imagination is important?
Oh, my goodness. I think it's one of the words that we need to claim and reclaim. If not every week, every day, you know, when I think about, you know, Walter Brueggemann's work on prophetic imagination was so impactful for me a number of years ago when I first read it, of envisioning a future marked by shalom, a future marked by justice, a future marked by love. And it's often the case that the failure of our formation is rooted in our lack of imagination. Our lack of our ability to envision life apart from the particular fractures and idols and places in which we are stuck. And so I do think cultivating an imagination is probably one of the most overlooked aspects of our lives in Christ and our formation.
Yeah. A principle we go back to a lot at Renovaria is Dallas Willard's idea that change always takes vision, intention, and means, and that you probably have to spend about 90% of your effort on vision. That if there isn't a vision, and I haven't made the connection before this conversation of the role of imagination in that, being able to imagine a different way of being together. Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
So then you dive in, you talk a little bit about the story of New Life, which is a great sort of petri dish for all of this. And there's a little footnote on page 49 where you say at New Life, you actually, when you talk about reconciliation, you talk about it on five fronts: race, ethnicity, I can never say that word right, economic reconciliation, gender, and generational. Part of the reason I'm bringing this up is I just want readers to notice that. It's interesting that you have this kind of real 360 on reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And then was it just for sort of scope and space that you decided to drill down on racial? Like, what was the decision to focus on ethnic background and race?
Yes. My initial drafts of part of it was that chapter would have been five times as long and became its own book in some ways. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about bridging racial, cultural, economic, gender, generational barriers at New Life, that's kind of, we use the word multiracial, although it's not the best word and we recognize the limit of that. But for the sake of the chapter, in light of just, I think the ongoing challenge, particularly in the United States, I mean, in North America, across the globe, really, of racial hostility, racial injustice. I just thought zeroing in on that particular area would be enough of a contribution. Ask of spiritual formation.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's certainly a particularly open wound at the moment. And I want to say, you know, the majority of our book club members are in the U.S., and this is very much a live issue in the U.S., but we do have people from all around the world. And I just want to invite them to do this work in their context. You know, for example, as I was reading this chapter, I'm in Canada, and we were observing our first National Day for Truth and Reconciliation around a very open wound around our history with Indigenous peoples. So I appreciate you very much working it out in your American context and how that will speak both to the American context where it desperately needs to speak, but everywhere else in the world where it desperately needs to speak. So thanks for that. On page 54, you work with some of Lisa Sharon Harper's definitions. We love her. We use her book, The Very Good Gospel, in the Renovar Institute. I still feel like a bunch of us will get tripped up on the definition difference between ethnicity, the word I can't say, and race. So ethnicity is like a real category. It's something ontologically real, and race is a construct. But I feel like we always get tripped up on that. So I want to hear it in your words. Help us understand how race is a construct.
Yeah, race is delineating, and not just the delineation of different people, but the assigning of value based on, I mean, if we're going to just be very clear here, race is a construct that was started to create a hierarchy in which, to be very clear, white people, white aesthetics, white perspective is seen up here on the top, and anything that was black is related all the way on the bottom here. Hmm. And so it's a way of categorization. It's a way of measuring value, measuring competence, measuring goodness. And so race is that, it's a construct that was established. So for example, as I try to lay out in the book, you know, there was a time when white people didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And by that I'm saying, it wasn't until, you know, whether it's the 1300s or 1400s, where that category of white began to get introduced into the larger conversation of colonialism and all the rest. But prior to that, there was no such categories. People were known by their ethnic backgrounds, by their national origins and such. Yet at the same time, because race and racism has played such a prominent role in how we understand the world as it exists today, it still is an important category to retain because of the ways that sin has manifested through the act of racism. Ethnicity is, that is a biblical term. That is a phrase that we, a term that we see come up in the scriptures, which speaks to a particular group of people at a particular time and place. So I use those often, you know, not necessarily interchangeably, but I use them in tandem with one another because I think it situates us in the world that we live in.
Yeah, that's helpful. So I want to ask you an annoying question. What I've noticed, so in the book club over several years, we've tried to work with books that can help us with this. So a few years ago, we did Reconstructing the Gospel, Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, which was really helpful. We did Thurman last year. One thing that I've noticed in our dialogue on this is somewhere probably halfway through Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove's book, Reconstructing the Gospel, was the first time I heard the phrase critical race theory. This was maybe like about 4 years ago, right? And sort of this, we must be very wary of critical race theory, right? And which seems like a very amorphous theory indeed to me, a phrase that gets thrown around to describe all different, anything that sort of looks at justice through a lens of who has power and who doesn't. People seem to sort of throw in the critical race theory bucket and then say that this is in some way antithetical or a threat to the gospel. And so I just want to ask you, is that live in your conversations with people, and how do you address it and think about it? Because it just seems to be one of those trigger things that kind of bucks people off the horse with this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, on one level, in my context in Queens, it has not come up as much as it has in other places in the United States. So I'll just say that. However, it does feel like a shark that's lurking and needing to devour someone, you know? Mm-hmm. That's the image that comes to mind in my context, where I'm already acknowledging that I wouldn't be surprised if there's resistance because people are watching cable news and they're getting information from people who are not critical race scholars on anything. But it's interesting though, because as my book is being used in various contexts like seminaries and colleges, I have started to get emails from people saying, "Hey, Rich, is what you're teaching critical race theory?" I'm thinking, I haven't even read on critical race theory. So I've had to actually begin to write down a few thoughts on critical race theory, which I'm happy to share those thoughts here if that would be helpful, but to help people understand at least how I'm approaching that topic as it relates to the larger theological commitment to racial justice and reconciliation.
Can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think about maybe 4 or 5 points that come to mind as it pertains to critical race theory. First, I always begin by saying, I'm a pastor, pastor theologian. I mean, I spend my life, I'm not a critical race scholar. So that's like the first thing I need to say.
Right.
And I think that's important, secondly, because in addressing matters of racism, for me, it's grounded in the pervasive nature of sin and my commitment to Holy Scripture. And so sin is not just something we do, it's a power that humanity is under. And so because I take sin seriously as a Christian, I'm aware of the ways that it touches individual hearts, mm-hmm. interpersonal relationships, and institutional realities we find ourselves in.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the second, like my commitment to Scripture is where I'm beginning the conversation and my understanding of sin. I'd say thirdly that I don't look to any ideology or school of thought as the all-encompassing frame to understand the world and individuals. And so, for example, CRT has this oppressor-oppressed framework, and it must be taken seriously. But our social estrangement has other roots that must be examined as well. And so I think that's kind of a third way of, I'm not looking to this particular way of thinking as my all-encompassing way of understanding the world. The starting point for me when it comes to engaging on matters of critical race theory is their goal is to identify the larger systemic realities that have existed in the United States as it pertains to law in particular. So it's a legal field. And sometimes there are overlapping concerns and interests or terms that between a biblical or from a theological approach, that there's just connection there. And so we should be looking for truth wherever truth is to be found. And then in many ways, CRT has just become the latest signifier to determine who's in and who's out. And our salvation is not determined on our adherence or even a resistance to a particular ideology. No, we're saved through Jesus Christ. And to the degree that Christians are now using this as a litmus test to determine who's in and out is actually, that's another bigger problem, I think, theologically. And so when I think about that, that's how I'm navigating through this particular landmine.
that is super helpful. Part of me feels bad bringing it up because you have done such a brilliant job navigating this topic from a biblical and lived experience paradigm, just kind of naming truth. And so it's incredibly helpful. But I know that concerns about that, pro and con, can hijack the conversation. So I appreciate you speaking to it. And very helpful. So then you move into chapter 4, where you give us these practices of racial reconciliation. But I think that this is the only chapter where you call them habits rather than practices. And I'm guessing there's some intentionality around why you called them habits.
It actually came from Eddie Glaude, who wrote a book called Democracy in Black. And he was the first one that I had seen make that connection of racial habits. And when I first read The Habits, for me, it just felt like, I don't know, it just hit me. I mean, these are the habits that we have to intentionally develop to the point where it becomes secondhand. I get up in the morning and brush my teeth because it's a habit I've established for many, many, many years. I get up in the morning and make myself a cup of coffee because it's just a habit. Yeah. Middle of the night, I'm eating ice cream because it's a habit. You know? So these are the things that have been formed in me. So that language I just found to be so important to connect racial realities and racism and racial justice reconciliation with these are habits that we're trying to form. So, I mean, more than anything, I think that language just resonated when I first read it.
Yeah, I wondered too, you know, I think most Christ followers on the front of personal bias, it's easy to say, I would never put on a robe and burn a cross, right? I'd never call somebody a name or whatever. And what I like about the habit language is it gets into implicit bias. It gets into the stuff that we have no idea is there.
There is an embodied nature to habits where it's in my bones. It's the very right. core of who I am and what I do. And we need a formation that's strong enough to get, not just to add some practices to help us, but to actually rewire our brains and yeah. reorient our bodies as it relates to some of these massive issues.
Yeah, really, really helpful. And probably related to that, I noticed you use the word residue a lot in this chapter. The residue of racial inequality and hostility. It just seemed like a very striking word to me. And maybe that's all I need to say about it. But anything else you would say about this idea of there being a residue?
Part of the reason I think I use that word is because I'm trying to locate this problem, not with this particular moment, but with this enduring, ongoing legacy of racial fragmentation, injustice, and hostility for many, many years in our context here in the United States. And so by residue, it's for me, it's trying to get at the idea that this is not a new problem. This is an enduring problem. And we're continuing, in some ways, residue might feel a little too soft of a word. Mm. But for me, it's more trying to connect the reality that this is not a new problem. This is something that has endured for many, many years.
Yeah. I think it's a powerful word. I hear what you're saying, that it could seem a little light, but to me, it's almost like an atmospheric word. Like it's something in the atmosphere. And, you know, yes, slavery has been abolished, but what's the residue? What's still in the atmosphere? Yeah, I think it's a really helpful word. You talk here and then again in chapter 6, which we're going to read this week, about the genogram. And I just wondered if you could give us a little bit more info about like where that comes from and if it interests our readers, where they could explore more about it.
Yeah, I think it emerges out of family systems theory, which is a discipline of mental health and therapy. The genogram's purpose is to trace the various patterns, the various observable repeated patterns, as well as the particular moments of whether it's trauma. You know, I'm looking at my generation from grandparents, great-grandparents, and I'm trying to notice where are the areas of repeated patterns that must be addressed and looked at. We use it at our church in many different contexts to help people explore the ways that their family of origin has handed down negative legacies that have marred us, that have hurt us, ways that we're continuing to pass down particular habits and practices. It's actually one of the ways to get at some of the deepest areas for healing is to look at a genogram. Pastorally, I've done it with many congregants where just let's look at your genogram and let's talk to me about your parents and talk to me about your grandparents and talk to me about the ecosystem of your family and what's the residue that remains in you today that we must begin to consciously and prayerfully examine. So the genogram is out of that emotional health family systems field. What I've tried to do is use that language to apply it more broadly in a national, our collective way of being together. Where have we been collectively? What has been handed down? What are the patterns that we need to begin to examine and begin to imagine a different way forward? So I would highly recommend people looking into the genogram. And my predecessor, you know, Pete Scazzaro, he did his doctorate in family systems theory with a focus on the genogram. So in his book, Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, he gives some really helpful language and theology for that as well.
Great. That'd be a great place to start. We have one of our ministry team members, Tina Dyer, will sometimes have us do a racial autobiography, like where you remember like the first time you became aware of race and, you know, this so it sounds kind of like a similar kind of exercise, at least in this one respect. And then you give us all these really helpful habits to cultivate, and the habit of renouncing whiteness. The first time I heard and you've addressed this already in our conversation, but the first time I even heard the concept of whiteness was on retreat with Willie Jennings. And, you know, him talking about, you know, people come from Ireland and Czech yeah. and all over the world and sort of like losing their accents as quickly as possible to try to achieve this, you know, kind of ideal of whiteness and its connection to the American dream and, you know, all that stuff. Okay, so I'm in Canada and I'm trying to renounce my whiteness. And I have gradually learned that a lot of it has to do with decentering whiteness. So like I've been a part of a lot of multicultural church experiments where everyone is welcome at the table, but us white folks are still the host at the table. And it's very subtle, right? But everyone else is sort of welcome to be in the orbit of our whiteness, but whiteness is still at the center. So now you have a different experience with respect to that, but any practical suggestions for somebody like me who wants to renounce my whiteness, wants to decenter whiteness, you know, as sort of the, yeah, just with food and music and all of it, right? So what have you seen experiments in that that have worked well? Not asking you to do our work for us, but any coaching is appreciated.
I think so much of it is just growing in awareness of these power dynamics. You know, what I don't define it in the book in this way, but when I think about whiteness, the way I try to explain it is that it is this insidious and often noxious, unconscious or sometimes conscious way that so-called white experience, perspective, aesthetics, power is prioritized, normalized, internalized, and systematized. I know there's a lot to take in here.
A lot of eyes. Yep.
And so it's prioritized. It's normalized. And here's the thing. You know, we talk a lot about COVID and transmissibility rates. You know, what's also highly transmissible is whiteness. Because it does not only infect white people. Whiteness is something that infects plenty of people. So for example, it's in me every time I seek to place a hierarchy of what is a good neighborhood and what's a not so good neighborhood. What's a good school and what's a not so good school? If I am just basing the presence of white people as the determining factor of whether something is good or not, I have been infected with whiteness in that way. And it's the way of creating this hierarchy, this, as Willie Jennings would say, this yardstick of measuring what is valuable and what is not. And so part of it, I do think, is during our hard work of identifying the frame, identifying the hierarchy, identifying the measuring stick, and sitting there and then beginning to work out the implications, beginning to do the counter-instinctual work, you know, opening myself to people and perspectives. So like, I mean, one, what seems like a very innocent and very simple way of doing this is, and many of my friends and others have used this as an example of looking at our bookshelves and I, you know, who are the perspectives and what are the perspectives and who are the people that have normalized and that we have prioritized and ultimately who we have internalized as good theology, as reputable, as people who can be trusted, trustworthiness. So I think looking at our own library, who are the non-white people and specifically non-white males that we have been learning from? Something like that can begin to sow the seeds of starting to get released from what I just talked about of this internalization, prioritization, and the ways that it gets systematized.
That's really helpful. And you're definitely speaking our language to go after our bookshelves. That's where your treasure is, there your heart shall be. So yeah, no, that's really, really helpful. And when you say non-white males, are you also saying there is a gender issue there as well?
Huge
diversity.
Huge issue, which is why at New Life, when we talk about bridging racial, cultural, economic, and gender barriers, that's really, and I had to learn that the hard way myself. You know, when we put together conferences at New Life, the gravitational pull is to just get the guys. And yet there's plenty of women who have something to say. So we've made some really intentional decisions beyond just our staffing, and we have more women pastors than we have men pastors at New Life. Mm-hmm. But beyond just that, who do we platform and who do we give opportunity to? So this is not just a racial issue. This is without question a gender issue as well.
Thanks. So good. Well, I'm sure when we do our webinar with you, our readers will have more questions about these chapters. There's so much more to say, but let's press on for the sake of you sometime getting off this call. The next two chapters are Interior Examination for a World Living on the Surface. And I love that what you point out in this chapter, that really the first value, that they're all about listening, these first three. The first one is about listening to God. The second one is about listening to each other. And this one is about listening to ourselves. I also just wanted to start a support group with you for biffed PowerPoint slides. when you've planned something so perfect and the slides don't come through. So I empathized with that inner rage more than I should probably, but I appreciate that story. For people who haven't read this yet, they'll know what we're talking about shortly. Okay, you work with a definition of sin that really captured my imagination. So when our readers get there, page 99, you say, sin is a principle of captivity to a power that permeates and contaminates our human reality. Sin is the word Christians use to name not simply our failed acts, it includes our failed acts, but also our inner and outer captivity. If we embrace a fuller understanding of the nature of sin, knowledge of self extends beyond our obvious acts of transgression or insufficiency to save ourselves. It also extends to the limits and failure of living lives marked by wholeness, this lack of wholeness. God in Christ takes on our sin so that we may live forgiven, free, and whole. This wholeness extends to every aspect of life. That just seems huge to me, and I just want to invite you to say more about it.
So if I can summarize that, what I would say is that sin is not just the bad things we do. It is it's a bad power that we are under. And so I'm thinking about it more so as outside of ourselves. There is something that has so infected the human condition, and not just the human condition. We're talking about all of creation. It's a power that leads to all kinds of captivity, all kinds of bondage. And so we often think of sin and sins, the bad things that we do, but we often never get to identifying the larger capital S sin that's beneath the sins. And so we can identify the sins and never get to the sin. And Jesus came not just to forgive us of our sins, but to overpower and deal with sin. And I think that's what's happened on the cross, where he became sin. And in the mystery of the cross overcomes it, that principle, that power. And I think that's just really important, number one, because it, first of all, I think it locates the defeat of sin outside of ourselves. This is something God does. This is something we can't do. This is something Christ has done. We cannot educate ourselves out of sin. We cannot create enough just policies to policy ourselves out of sin. We can't make enough good decisions to moralize our way out of sin. We need a power outside of ourselves. And I think this is what we've seen in Jesus Christ. Framing in that way, I think, locates the really larger power as well as the larger solution that we need for it. To say that Christ has handled sin is not to say that we don't have to do anything, but it is to say that in so much as we attach our lives to Christ, and are in union with Christ and saying yes to the way of Christ, we begin to push back sin in such a way that ultimately we're waiting for him to make all things new. But in the process, as we connect to Christ, we're able to, in some respects, boundary sin and its impact and the destructive force that it has in our world.
So can you help us think about how that maps on to this interior journey? Like, we often say that the journey of spiritual formation is this journey from self-deception to self-awareness. And so how does this awareness of not only sins, but the power of sin that we're under, how does that map onto that journey, or how do they relate?
No, on one level, I think it relates in that back to the solution, like the solution to my malformation is not in me just trying a couple of practices here and there. You know, it's okay, I'm going to add a habit or two, and we're going to get rid of sin.
Yeah. You know,
our formation is ultimately contingent upon God working in us, God working through us. This is the work of God. So when we talk about the daily office, you know, that it is the work of God. Prayer is the work of God. And so I think I'm trying to situate our own interior examination, our own spiritual formation, not as it relates to our human effort and the ways that we can work something up ourselves, but by opening ourselves up to a power outside of ourselves and trying now to incorporate our lives in that power. And so I think more than anything, it's a cautionary word to thinking that our formation is in our hands, ultimately. Our formation, it's in God's hands. And to the degree that we place ourselves in God's hands in that way, will we have the kind of depth and life that we're really longing for.
Yeah, that's really helpful. This might not be a helpful tangent, in which case I'll edit it out, but my Orthodox friends sometimes talk about us inheriting death at the fall. We're inheriting death. And one friend in particular, Gary Moon, he says, just imagine you're a computer and you get unplugged and you're still a great computer, but you are dying, right? Like your death is inevitable and you can only live and be the computer, like, you know, and a computer is a very reductionistic metaphor, but stick with me for a sec. Yeah. The computer can only come back to life if it plugs back in. And so sometimes I think about our practices as plugging back in, like we have no power at all to give ourselves life or victory over sin, liberation from captivity, but practices help us plug back into the source of life. Does that map onto what you're saying, or is it a different idea?
Well, I like it a lot. And I think that's absolutely right. I think we are locating the ultimate source of life, which conquers the powers of sin and death, outside of ourselves. And so it is this, I mean, I was hanging around with some Wesleyans recently. So it is this this cooperative grace at work, you know, it's God working on our behalf. It's operational in us. But then there's this cooperative part. And I think that's the formational practices where we're not trying to make something happen. We're trying to ride with the current of God's grace and allowing the Spirit to flow through us. And I think that's what formational practices ultimately do.
Yeah.
It's really abiding as opposed to striving.
Very helpful. Thank you. So I said that we often talk about this journey from self-deception to self-awareness. And I think these chapters are masterful on what that journey can look like. It's just my personal project to always figure out how this journey to self-awareness can lead to self-forgetfulness. Because ultimately we want to be joyfully self-forgetful and free of ourselves. And you deal with this when you say one of the things that makes people uneasy is, will this lead to self-absorption? But do you see self-awareness as essential to self-forgetfulness, even though those at first blush seem like they might be at odds with each other?
No, absolutely. I think of something Dietrich Bonhoeffer said. I can't recall if it's in Cost of Discipleship. It might be in Cost of Discipleship, actually, as he's talking about the Sermon on the Mount. And he writes about our left hand not knowing what our right hand is doing. And, you know, it's in the context of generosity and not being so self-obsessed with our generosity that it just comes so naturally to us. And I remember reading that from Bonhoeffer, of course, from Jesus. But then the way that Bonhoeffer said it, interpreted that passage for me, I thought, that is the goal of the spiritual life, to grow in awareness, yes, that leads, and the way that you just said it, Carolyn, I haven't heard it that way before, holding those two together, but it is to lead to the self-forgetfulness where I'm not even aware of my own so-called goodness. I'm not aware of my deeds. I'm not aware of my own growth. I think spiritual formation happens best, I could attest personally, when I am not obsessing over whether I'm growing or not. When I get to the point of, am I growing or not? It's almost like the spotlight is back on me again, as opposed to the spotlight being on union with God and doing God's will. It now becomes very perfectionism oriented and driven by my own human effort, and it's just a burden to carry. And so there have been times when, in retrospect, I look back and I go, oh, wow, I didn't even realize I was doing that act of goodness. And then I get caught in it because I start thinking about my
yeah.
The cyclical thing here.
It's a journey, yes. Yeah.
But I do think self-awareness, that's beautifully said, ideally grows to the point where our left hand is not knowing what our right hand is doing.
Yeah. And yet there's work to be done along the way, because you will encounter people who say, oh, I never think of myself. And you think, well, actually, I wish you would just hold a mirror up to this one area for a few minutes. Like there's C.S. Lewis has this character called Mrs. Fidget in The Four Loves, where he says, you know, Mrs. Fidget lived for others. You could tell the others by their hunted expressions, right? Like she you know, she thought that she was being self-forgetful, but there were these blindnesses, right? That's this trick, is this invitation to wake up to things in ourselves that need to be healed and made holy for the purpose of leaving that behind. But there's some dialectic there where
and I don't know if I'm ever going to achieve the kind of forgetfulness that my soul really longs for, because it's like humility. It's once I think I've achieved it, that's when I So it keeps us
for sure. Always beginners, like Merton said, not just with prayer, but with all of it. One thing that jumped out at me when you got to, it's in the part where you're talking about, I love that you said our two big challenges are busyness and compartmentalization when it comes to this interior life. But you talked about sometimes when you ask your congregation, not only what are they afraid of and what's hurting them, but what do they want? Like, what are their dreams? What are their longings? And that kind of like, I realized for most of these chapters, I'd been thinking about becoming more aware of the parts of me that are broken and need healing and places where sin has a hold. But there's also, what do you think about waking up to what we want and our desires and how God has designed us to long for? Is there a positive trajectory to that as well?
Oh, yeah. You know, Ron Rollheiser has said that one of the goals of the church is to help people make sense of their longings. And I think there's something really powerful and important there. It's usually the case that I think most people don't have a context to give regular expression to their longings, their hopes, and their dreams. For example, just recently, we have this course called Emotionally Healthy Relationships that we lead, and I lead it usually once a year with a bunch of our congregants. And we teach a skill, it's the first week, which is, it's funny, it's not CRT, it's CTR. So it's the community temperature reading. And what it does is it locates five areas to help people give expression to what's happening on the inside. And the five areas are, first is just appreciations. So let's say I'm in a conversation with you, Carolyn, just appreciation. I appreciate you taking the time. You know, the second thing is puzzled. It's giving someone the benefit of the doubt. You're not making assumptions as to why they did something or didn't do something. Mm-hmm. So, and you cut your sin in half when you actually use the word puzzle instead of coming to conclusions. So it's puzzle. Mm-hmm. The third is complaints with requests for change. It's I notice and I prefer. The fourth is new information. And then the fifth is hopes and dreams. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I were demonstrating this before people on a Zoom course live, just what are your hopes and dreams? And it just hit me again as I was looking in her eyes and saying, honey, these are my hopes. These are my dreams for our family. And she said the same. It just reminded me again how often we don't have a space to articulate our deepest longings. And so I think the church, good spiritual formation, helps us not just to name our sins and our anxieties and our anger and our frustrations, but it gives us language to say, these are the things my soul is hungry for, yearning for, longing for, my hopes and my dreams, and listening to God in that space as well.
Really great. Compartmentalization, do you think that this might be a bigger issue actually for Christians than maybe for some others? like a particular temptation?
100%, because I think Christians have more problems than probably the rest of the world because of their theology. But, you know, it's particularly problematic for Christians because of the inherited theology flowing out of Platonism, flowing out of Gnosticism, that says that the body is bad and the soul is good. And so we've had to work through that throughout, last 2000 years or so. Mm-hmm. And because that is often the primal theological ways that we're oriented, we are so prone to compartmentalizing parts of ourselves that need to be integrated because we don't think it's holy enough. We don't think it's godly enough. I think Christians for sure have a problem with this because of the ways that we have created these dichotomies of what is good and what is bad. And very simply, what's often good is the soul, and only when it's oriented towards God in very specific so-called spiritual practices. And what's bad is the body, especially mm-hmm. when it's leading us to paying attention to the various appetites and longings that we have. And so this is an ancient problem that we still haven't figured out yet.
Yeah. And I think too, certainly how I was raised, there was such a emphasis on being a good witness that very quickly turned into image management and denial of certain inner realities, and which keeps us firmly rooted in this, you know, like you said, bring all the parts of yourself into the light and love of God's company. And
it's why, at least at New Life, and this is not something novel, but I think it's worth saying, you know, we don't say negative emotions at New Life. We say difficult emotions because anger and sadness and anxiety, these are not negative. They're difficult. Right. But if we begin to attach positive and negative, what that's going to lead us to doing everything that we can to avoid them. And then we're living all kinds of duplicitous lives, and we're lying, and we're trying to keep up our image and being joyful, because of course joy is the only acceptable emotion. And yet we have a book called Lamentations, and Jesus is a man of sorrows and everything else. So resisting that compartmentalization is, I think, particularly difficult for Christians.
Difficult rather than negative. That's really helpful. Okay, one last one before I let you go for now. You give us these four areas to examine, practices of examination: family, anxiety, feelings, and reactions. Super, super helpful stuff. Just on anxiety, so it's sort of a truism that gets thrown around that we are, you know, I have young adult children, and I'm told all the time that they're the most anxious generation in history. Do you think that's true? And do you have any ideas as to why?
Depending on how we define anxiety, you know, if anxiety is defined by fretting and fear and, oh no, this is going to go wrong. Perhaps, I don't know, maybe our exposure to the world in ways that we'd never had before through social media and the internet is probably good cause for a heightened sense of anxiety in our world. There are problems that I did not know about as a child that my children know about because of access to information. So that might be it. But if anxiety is defined as the automatic response to a perceived or real threat, then I think that's what it means to be human. And I think that's every generation. To be human is to be anxious. And to be anxious is not simply expressed in feelings of fear. It could be expressed in feelings of control and manipulation and anger and obsessiveness. And that's anxiety as well. And so I remember hearing a pastor, a very well-known pastor, say, you know, anxiety is just not my thing. I'm not an anxious person. And I'm thinking, well, not a human then, because again, it's an automatic response. And we all have various automatic response. And it might not look like anxiety, but the fact that we express it that way is anxiety. So I think part of it is how we define it. And then as it relates to this generation, I'm not a sociologist, so I don't know if that's true, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's true because of the nature of how much access we have to information in the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, that really back to, I guess this was in our previous conversation about Sabbath keeping and sort of surrendering omnipresence. It made me actually think of this anxiety connection sort of, you know, yeah, that my kids, if something awful happens on the other side of the world, they know about it instantly in a way that I never had to carry growing up. So I'm with you on that analysis, but you're also making me think, huh, maybe our kids just call anxiety what it is. And some of the generations before it called it, I'm on top of things, right? Like over-controlling, denial, compartmentalization, duplicity, you know, maybe they're a more transparent generation.
Yeah, all manifestation of anxiety.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great insight. Well, among many, thank you. This book is fantastic. And there are two huge values to go that will be challenging and so, so helpful. We won't have another podcast, but we will have a live webinar where I will put to you all the questions that have been submitted on all the sections of the book. So thanks for being game for that. And we'll be looking forward to it.
Thanks so much. This was wonderful, Carolyn. Thanks for the conversation.